This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 10th of June 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the US is bolstering its forces in Iraq in a substantial new strategy to combat ISIS. 400 new army trainers will be stationed in the region. I'll be asking my guests, Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled, whether they feel a creeping sense of déjà vu. Burma's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi is on her first official visit to China. She's treading a careful diplomatic line. Don't expect comments on human rights as she seeks to build relations with the country's neighbour ahead of this year's Burmese elections. And as NATO fights to maintain its relevance in the face of the growing Ukraine crisis, a new survey suggests that at least half of all Germans, French and Italians say their country should not use military force to defend a NATO ally. We'll be asking if the organisation still has teeth in Europe. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Daniela Peled, Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Kathleen and Daniela, welcome both to the programme. We begin with Iraq. The United States has announced plans for a new military base in Anbar province in the west of the country, which will house 400 military training staff to add to the nation's current force of 3,100 trainers and advisors in the country. The move comes as Barack Obama faces criticism for having no clearly defined strategy against ISIS in either Iraq or Syria, and the new troops will assist with efforts to retake Anbar's regional capital, Ramadi, which of course fell to ISIS last month. Kathleen Burke, it's very easy to look at this and think, well, here's another 400. In 6 months' time, will there be another, you know, 200 or 300? Is this a sort of a slow sort of new mission creep?
Well, probably almost certainly. It's difficult. I mean, you have to feel sorry for Barack Obama on this. He was elected on the grounds that he'd be taking the troops out. You take the troops out, the place falls apart. Masses of pressure, domestic as well as international, to do something, anything. The something, anything, is either send troops or to send, could be trainers, or to send military hardware. The military hardware keeps getting abandoned and taken up by ISIS. It's hard to know what else he can do. Britain is also sending 125, so the United States won't be alone on this. If I had to look around Europe, probably I'd think maybe the Poles might send, because they are, of course, willing to fight as well. But I literally don't see what else he can do. I really don't. It's the best of a bad job.
Daniela Peled, when we say trainers, these aren't necessarily people who are going to do workshops and brainstorms. It's not trainers in that sense. But when we look at the record of US troops training the Iraqi army, for instance, the Iraqi army they trained fell apart the moment that ISIS threatened them.
That's absolutely true, but it's also to do with other complex reasons of the Iraqi government that America was happy to see left in Iraq, because it was so keen and eager to leave. Complex reasons why the Iraqi army disintegrated so fast. But also they're not going to be running workshops, but also, as I understand it, this is at brigade level. These troops, these trainers are going to stay in the barracks. And really, there's no alternative but to have actually forces on the ground to call in airstrikes, to have a much more proactive role if they're going to make any significant difference. This is maybe hugely unpopular. Maybe this is not politically expedient. But in terms of something that's actually going to make a difference, I really can't see any alternative to that.
I suspect the mission creep that will happen is sending in spotters, because you can claim they're not there and so forth. But if you're going to have proper air support, as you've implied, you have to have the spotters and you have to have the communications equipment. So if we're going to creep, I suspect that's the direction in which the creeping is going to go.
You've used the word, the phrase mission creep. I used it at the beginning. I'm sure it won't be long before one of us mentions the slippery slope. And yet, Daniela, is there an argument that it doesn't necessarily have to go any further than this? This can be, you know, the measure that the Americans think this will make a considerable difference. We're not necessarily going to end up with, you know, more US troops on the ground inside Iraq again.
Well, I mean, it's not a very popular thing to say, but I'm not sure why this is seen as a bad thing. Not every intervention is the same as every other intervention. I was talking to a friend in Baghdad today, another journalist, and he was saying, well, this is the only thing that is going to make a difference. And the numbers are not enough. And he, to my surprise, thought it was really possible to defeat ISIS at this point, to make a difference, to push them back. If there was a proper push, if it was a concerted effort. I wish there'd been mission creep already 2 years ago. I mean, I don't feel that sorry for Barack Obama, because he really missed a trick in 2013 when he allowed his red line in Syria to be extremely wobbly and to be redrawn numerous times. I think that's partly what we've been left, the situation we have here. And really, and this is why I disagreed with my friend in Baghdad who I was talking to, that I think that the West needs to act very firmly and make a real effort in Iraq, because that's the only part of this conflict where it can make a difference. Because in Syria, the vacuum is just too great, really. And in Iraq, there is still some structure left that we can leverage.
It's a problem with a democracy, isn't it? I mean, if you've got parliament saying, no, you're not going to, if you've got public opinion not with you in the United States, one has to take a decision on how autocratic a popular leader one wants. I mean, the problem is, of course, once things are in appalling shape, of course, then everyone wants to know why it hasn't been done. But part of my sympathy was Obama having been elected on getting the boys back home, knowing there wasn't any political support to speak of outside of the Pentagon, you know, the Republican side of Congress and a few people around, how is he actually going to support? Now, I agree with you. A surge would probably be a very good thing here. But can you just imagine Obama standing up or David Cameron standing up saying, we're going to send 8,000 troops in to clean up this mess? And people will say, right, that's the third time in the past 11 years you've done this.
I think the problem, though, why I'm less forgiving with Obama is he hasn't shown any decisiveness in any area of his foreign policy, you know, across the spectrum. And I'd be very surprised to see Cameron standing up and making any foreign policy announcement at all.
Kathleen, it's interesting from a historical perspective, because we often accuse politicians of not understanding history properly when it comes to interventions around the world. And yet when you look at what's happening in Iraq right now, it seems like everyone is referring to very recent history as their guide to what to do. So if you were someone who was against the war in Iraq in the first place, then you are likely to be the sort of person who then says, well, this, you know, we can't send more troops back there again. That will just make the situation worse.
And of course, not sending troops back could probably just make the situation worse. It's the best of a bad deal. It's going to be difficult to bring this to a conclusion without support in Iraq. Now, what we haven't a clue how to do is how to build this support in Iraq. I mean, if you've got essentially, if you start arming, you know, sending the troops and whatever to Anbar province, which is mostly Sunni, and you have most of the workable Iraqi army and militias right now being Shia, does that mean that sending this in creates a really nice scenario for yet another civil war in Iraq? It's a problem. What can the West actually do properly?
Daniel, on that point of what the West can do, I mean, and to go back to that issue of sort of, you know, do people who were in favour of, you know, the intervention in Iraq in the first place, you know, have you know, are they often thinking, well, it's, you know, this worked the first time, or this was the answer the first time, therefore we're sending more troops? Whereas those that were against it think, oh, I'm not sure about sending troops back into Iraq. It's almost as if we can't quite see, this is the problem right in front of us, what's the way of dealing with this right now?
No, absolutely. There's an enormous amount of baggage. And one of the reasons is the Iraq War was the defining political moment for a whole generation of people, not just in the West. And that was, there were some enormous mistakes made. But to see this as equivalent to that, I think, is a real mistake as well, perhaps because it's so recent. And that's why we haven't got any historical perspective. But even to look at containing what is happening to Syria in Iraq, it requires action rather than being passive and trying to defend borders which no longer exist. And without that, I think we're really, really heading into very, very dark territories.
Kathleen?
Well, just it's your defining moment of a generation, of course. Previous generation, the defining moment was Vietnam. And what happens? Vietnam is asking the United States, please come in and help save us from China. I think that's what I mean. If we have any historical knowledge at all, is that things do not remain the same. And what we think we can predict now often turns out not to be the thing. And gosh, that's why I guess I'm glad I'm not President Obama.
Daniela, on the sort of the broader strategy in Iraq, aside from bringing in more US troops, whether that's involved in spotting or whether that's involved in training, do you get the sense that there is now an Iraqi government that the US feels more comfortable working with? There is sort of the beginnings of an Iraqi security services that the West is more comfortable working with?
That might be the case, but I think Catherine's right that you have to watch out for this Sunni Shia divide. What I think perhaps we're underestimating is that the Sunni tribes, which were extremely alienated by the previous government and previous policy in Iraq, actually are not, in the long term, that supportive of ISIS. This is not the future that they want for their country, this extremely, extremely conservative vision. And so I think in the long term, I think this support for ISIS, because there's large areas of support rather than control, I think perhaps that is the tipping point which needs to be pushed at. So, especially so as to avoid turning this into a Sunni and Shia issue.
I mean, I think that's a really important point. And the thing is, the crux is there. If you're a Sunni, are you more scared of ISIS? Or are you more scared of Shia? I mean, that tends to be, that's why they're worried about going into various areas, isn't it? Because we don't even really know what the tipping point is.
Kathleen, I just want to touch on the US political situation at the moment, because, I mean, when are we not in election season in the US? But we're about to enter quite a big one with the race for the White House in 2016. How important is what's happening in Iraq going to be on that race? And how much will that race impact on what President Obama feels he can and can't do in Iraq?
I don't think it's going to have much impact on Obama because he has no place to go. No third-term presidents anymore. So in that case, I think we don't have to worry too much about it. Unless there's a real crisis on, American elections are not won on foreign policy. So I think except at the fringes, it's not going to have that much of an impact. So I think, and besides which, the election's not, thank God for small favors, until November 2016. So any decisions that are taken in the next 4 or 5 months aren't going to have much of an impact on the election.
And Daniela, here in the UK, you scoffed at the idea of David Cameron having anything to say on foreign policy. We're just out of an election where, frankly, no one had anything to say about foreign policy. We had things to say about foreigners, mainly that we don't seem to like them, we don't want them to come here, but nothing about foreign policy. To the extent that the adventure in Iraq has affected the way that Britain sees its role in the world, there's likely to be no input whatsoever.
Very, very little. Very, very, very little. You know, Tony Blair had from the beginning this vision of Britain on the world stage, an important world actor, and he was very aggressive and very muscular, to put it very kindly, in pushing forward that agenda. Cameron has also from the start had the opposite view, and this whole obsession over the EU and the referendum is going to suck all the energy out of this country's foreign and probably domestic policy over the
although,
next
and
years.
You say that, and certainly earlier on David Cameron would make comments of you can't impose democracy from 40,000 feet, and yet he intervened in Libya, was very strong rhetorically, certainly in terms of wanting to get rid of Gaddafi. Again, the rhetoric was strong on Assad in Syria, and he wanted to take some sort of action on that wobbly red line that you mentioned before, before Parliament said no you shouldn't. Do you think there's an interventionist struggling to get out of there in Downing Street?
If there was, then the struggle has been won. I really think now that the focus is on keeping his own party together and struggling through this Europe referendum come what may.
Okay, we'll move on. Burmese politician Aung San Suu Kyi spent 15 years under house arrest in her home country. Now free after recent reforms in Burma, the leader of the NLD opposition party is making her first visit to neighbouring China today. And there have been calls for her to acknowledge freedom of speech issues, such as that of Nobel Peace Prize winner Liu Xiaobo, who was jailed for 11 years in 2009 on subversion charges for organising a petition urging an end to one-party rule. However, so far, there's been no mention of that topic or indeed any other human rights issues on Aung San Suu Kyi's trip to China. And Kathleen Burke, in a way, that's not surprising, is it?
I think this is an extremely complicated situation and an extremely complicated visit. I mean, on the one hand, Burma, for hundreds of years, was a so-called tributary kingdom for China. So therefore, China has in her blood, as it were, the idea of Burma as distinctly subordinate. They've had border fights, which we can talk about a bit more if you want to in due course, which are happening right now, which are extremely interesting and complicated. So the thing is that China was being such a juggernaut and went from conquest then to colonization by economics, one might say, that Burma's leader stood up by starting to cultivate the West, changing the rules, changing the political culture, releasing Suu Kyi and so forth. So the question is, why is she there? Is she there to say something at home? But I don't see how that would be. Is she in China to say something on behalf of Burma for China? What quite would that be? She's not gone there for human rights because she wouldn't be able to accomplish anything except perhaps to go back into house arrest.
And Danielle, this is the interesting thing for Western supporters of Aung San Suu Kyi, who I think it's fair to say have been slightly disappointed over the past couple of years from their own very simple sort of standpoint of what they feel that she should be doing, because she hasn't spoken up about the persecution of the Rohingya. She hasn't, she won't even say the word Rohingya, let alone defend them in any way. But do you feel that sort of Western liberals who saw her as this sort of Nelson Mandela-like icon perhaps really don't understand the difficulty she has with domestic Burmese politics in the sense of how she's actually going to get herself elected?
Absolutely. I mean, Nelson Mandela wasn't even Nelson Mandela. You know, this is the view that Western liberals have of activists in repressive regimes is perhaps a little starry-eyed, and now she's no longer under house arrest. She has to look at the practicalities. She wants her party to do well in the elections coming up later this year. And although she can't at the moment stand for president, I'm sure she hasn't ruled it out at some point in the future. These are all practical considerations. And if anything, she wants to show herself now to be a stateswoman, if that's a word, rather than a human rights activist. I don't know why even people are surprised by this. You know, this seems entirely logical to me.
And indeed, she wasn't a human rights activist in the purest sense. She was a politician.
She was a politician. So I'm not sure that this is just a reversal in the last 5 years. I think this is what politicians have to do and what they have to do to survive. And you could argue plausibly that in the long run, she will have more of an impact than... I really don't understand what people expect her to go make a stirring statement about human rights in China and then return never to come back again.
Also, one questions who'd actually read that stirring statement on human rights in China, because it's unlikely to feature much in either the Chinese media or the Burmese media.
No, they'd read it in the West and they might feel very good about it, but that's as far as it would go.
Kathy, you mentioned, you know, China's relationship with Burma and actually how that sort of then played on Burma deciding to open up in the limited way that it has towards the West. Do you think that in a way the West got played a little bit on this, that Burma sort of had a few reforms, most strikingly of all, of course, allowing Aung San Suu Kyi to be released and to campaign freely, even if she can't actually be president. And yet the generals have still kept an incredibly tight grip.
Yes. And it's hard work being an icon, I should have thought. I'm not convinced she actually wanted to be. It's very uncomfortable. It's hard to know what we think ought to happen. Democracy as such comes out of roots and popular desires and so forth and so on. And I think considering the state Burma was in for generations, it's done rather well in terms of new laws and relatively limited but still freedoms that weren't there before. The idea that they have turned towards the West shows how apprehensive they are about China. The fact that they've had the courage to turn towards the rest is, I think, really interesting. And remember, they stopped the huge Chinese dam at the headwaters of the Irrawaddy River, in fact, which Suu Kyi, as you know, was helping to organize protests against. I guess it's just that we forget just how bloody large and powerful and dominant China is there, and the fact that they've actually had the courage to reject China to the extent they have, I think makes it, in geopolitical terms, quite a brave small country. Perhaps what she's trying to do is to soften relationships between the two of them. What she can get, heaven knows.
Kathleen Burke, Daniela Peled, thank you both. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
It's full steam ahead with the new transport-themed issue of Monocle that includes our survey of the best in class from cars to trams, planes to trains. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the design section, we rail for better design aboard the newly launched Union Pearson Express train in Toronto. We also report on a Hellenic revival in the fashion industry and survey the sunnier offerings from the world of outdoor furniture.
In the edit section, we make ourselves at home in Juarez for this month's property prospectus, meet a perky coffee machine maker in Tuscany, and break bread in Bondi with a few healthy recipes from chef Guy Turland.
The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Daniela Peled and Kathleen Burke. A new survey about NATO undertaken by the Washington think tank, the Pew Research Centre, suggests that many Europeans do not believe that their nations should actually assist a fellow ally if it were actually under attack. NATO's charter dictates that an attack on one nation is an attack on all. But the new survey says that at least half of all Germans, Italians and French polled believe they should not step in if a NATO ally was to be attacked by Russia. Daniela Peled, are you surprised at this sort of lack of solidarity from our European cousins?
I'm not surprised with the, certainly with the way that it's fallen. If you look at the different countries polled, and I think partly this is a problem that's common to many supranational organisations, in that they don't really make very much of an effort to sell themselves to the people or to explain what they do, what their purpose are, and the benefits are. I'm thinking of our, as I mentioned earlier, Britain's own very particular struggles over EU and EU membership, and the EU is not very good at selling itself either. What I found more interesting, really, about the poll was over Ukraine, had the divisions and the relatively small amounts of people who seem to see the blame clearly being put at Russia. And I think a quarter of people in the UK said they just didn't know. They didn't know who was responsible for who was the driving force in the conflict in Ukraine. Things like that, I think, are perhaps more revealing.
Kathleen, in some ways, the NATO Charter is abundantly clear. I think it's Article 5, which says if a country is attacked, attack on one is an attack on all. And so let's say London were bombed, then I think everyone in NATO would agree that constitutes an attack. Right. Come on. We're going in wherever in is now. But what happens if a few hundred little green men turn up in the Estonian countryside without any Russian insignia on? What happens then?
Well, the Estonians are prepared for that, of course. They've already got their plans ready, as do Latvia and Lithuania, because that's the obvious place where it's going to happen. They've all got, certainly Estonia and Latvia have one quarter of their population is Russian-speaking. NATO will have to react. I mean, what was interesting, I agree entirely with Daniela's comments, but what was also interesting to me is that one thing that brought them all together was the belief that the United States should come in and save them. that's one for all. We'll forget the all for one. I think Europe has gotten in the habit of being at peace. It's hard.
It's a good habit to be at, though.
Yeah, okay, unless there's threatening non-peace, and then you don't know what to do. I think there's also the assumption for so long that if anything happens, the U.S. will lead, the U.S. will do. The usual countries, France, the United Kingdom, and Poland will also help, but they're the ones who maintain significant armies and air forces. The others don't. You'd think, I mean, it's only been two generations since there was 100 years of war in Europe. Why people think it's never going to happen again, I really don't understand. The only understanding I have is because there's nuclear weapons, they hope to God it won't happen again. But wishing doesn't necessarily make it so. And it is rather scary right now that NATO doesn't seem to be able to get its act together.
Daniela, NATO has perhaps been scrambling around for a purpose to exist for, a good 25 years now. And perhaps in some ways now it's found it, in that, there are countries in NATO that are on Russia's border that have genuine reason to feel threatened. And yet, as you say, NATO hasn't necessarily done a very good job of convincing, ordinary people who are in it, like us, that actually this is worth it. Now, do you think that's because we might look at, people in Germany might look at France and think, yes, they're our brothers, they're people we want to support. But they might look at Latvia and go, do we really want to sort of cast, how have we ended up casting our lot in with these guys?
Yeah, but perhaps. Also, the Soviet Union was a sort of greater, scarier, more amorphous threat than Russia, which is basically, we're coming down to a very binary issue here. But again, the problem with surveys are it's a general sample of the population over a kind of general threat that may happen, that may not happen.
I think if there were an actual threat and a prime minister was to come on TV and say, we're in trouble, we need to do this,
I think there'd be a much more plausible case. You could make a much more plausible case for action that would convince a lot more of their constituents.
Kathleen, very briefly, we've got 15 seconds left.
Okay, Soviet Union and Russia. Soviet Union was predictable. Russia is not, and that's the danger.
There we are. That was even better. That was 7 seconds. Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Taymor Joveda Williams. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Chris Lord will be here for the next half hour. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That is, of course, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.